This is an interview with Kenneth Manchester. This interview is taking place in New Hope, Pennsylvania on October 13, 2004.
Yeah, if we can use tracers to really identify where these ions are.
Okay.
And I said, I think we can come up with a way of partitioning the substrate so that we can look at it in depth. So he said, well, let me talk this over with Gerald and we'll see if we can do this. And so Gerald came back and said, yeah. And he said, I think we can mix P32 with P31. And that's exactly what you want, you know.
Okay.
So they devised another holder, which we could use. See, there's a problem that you've got to get over with Oak Ridge as far as radiation protection.
Okay.
And so there's limits to what you can do with, with radio tracers.
Okay.
And so he set up a holder for our samples that we can put our 5/16 squares in.
Okay. Okay.
But monitor them so that we could measure, or we could dope with the P32 or the P32 and measure the P31 coming up with the holder. The separation was such that the 32 would hit where we wanted a sample and 31 on a collector.
Okay.
So using the isotope ratio that exists there, we measure what we're getting on the on the radio tracers by measuring that. So we set up that that holder, and it worked very nice. And we could only do about 12 samples at a time with this setup, and we could do a whole reel like we did before.
Okay.
But that worked good. And so we ran again the three orientations of silicon, and we see, how did we do this? Oh, we put in a low dosage of the tracer element. I think it was somewhere around 10 to the 11th. It corresponded to about 10 to the 11th ions per centimeter on the sample.
Okay.
But we put this in, we put that in, and then we put in the remainder in, in P31 to bring it up to 5 times 10 to the 14th, I think, which gives us measurable numbers.
Okay.
And we put that in three ways. The first time we put it in the amount of tracer, the small tracer, followed by the remainder of the of the P31 to bring it up to 5 to 10 to minus 14. The next one we put in about one or two times 10 to the 14th ions of the 31, then put the tracer in, and then followed up with the remainder of the P31.
Okay.
And then finally we put in all of the P31 first and then the tracer last.
Okay.
And the reason we did this is we wanted to see whether there was any influence on the penetration as far as channeling, if there was any. So we ran that series experiment, and it worked fine. I mean, the accelerator, those are great pieces of equipment. It worked great, and we got our samples and got home and devised a technique to remove, actually I could remove 1,000 angstroms at a time of silicon. And so we would remove it, and it was an oxidation process. So we would oxidize that surface and then dissolve that oxide,
mm-hmm.
and then measure the activity of it.
Okay.
And also measure the activity of the rest of the sample.
Okay.
So we kind of had a check and double check.
Okay. Okay.
And we did that step by step,
mm-hmm.
until we got, I guess it went down 10 or 12,000
angstroms. Okay.
And we corrected the data back to the
mm-hmm.
To the time that they were implanted,
mm-hmm.
because of the decay factor.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And then plotted the concentration as a function of the depth.
Yes.
And we got the nicest curves. And what was really pleasing was they matched almost exactly the calculated depth and shape of that Sharp and Schiott and Linhart had done. They made range calculations for a little number of different materials.
Okay.
This is just based on their isotope studies. And these were all just, they were calculations. They weren't proof. But anyway, they just fit just almost exactly. And we found with the varying the position of the tracer in the dose that when we put the tracers in initially, we got deeper penetration.
Okay.
Then when we put in the middle and the lead, you could see it just go up. And so that kind of indicated either there was, we were blocking the channel some way, either by damage or by just knocking atoms out of the silicon, which were now into the channel, or whatever. So we got, and looking at the different orientations, of course, we got different depths of penetration, and they agreed. I mean, the other two were about the same, but less than the open channel one. So then the next thing we needed to do was to determine whether there was any diffusion. As I say, we saw that by delineation you could see the junction move, and we had to determine whether that was just due to the diffusion, or whether it was due to changing ions into substitutional, or whatever. So we then annealed these. We had originally, in order to establish these things, we originally determined that there was a good anneal condition. I think for phosphorus it was about 600 degrees, 10 minutes, something like that, and boron it was a bit more. And that seemed to bring us up to bulk properties. So anyway, we took one of the samples and annealed it, and the other sample we ran as is, and did the same procedure of for delineating the depth, and we found that the two curves run exactly the same.
Wow.
So it said that the ions weren't moving.
Absolutely.
But what was evidently happening is we were reducing the damage, and a lot of the ions that were not substitutional were not jumping into position, and were now in a position where they could donate electrons.
Okay.
So that kind of took care of that. So it at that point, we were very, very positive that now that we knew the shape, we could, we knew what to do as far as the process of making ICs or what have you, and we were pretty confident that that this was a good technique for using as some kind of a diffusion source or what have you. So we just really wanted to go a bit further. We did some hall measurements on these samples to determine whether the the mobilities were what they should be for a bulk sample,
okay.
And whether the hall constants were, were okay. And we went through those studies, and they showed that the effectively the mobilities were the same as bulk
sodium. Okay.
And I mean, everything was just falling right in place. So that that was pleasing. And I think somewhere now, after we'd done that, somewhere along the line, I did a series of implants, one of which was a base implant, which was a phosphorus implant, and followed by a boron implant after a masking. And that created the first ion implanted transistor, planar transistor.
So that was done also at Oak Ridge, right? You used the Oak Ridge machine?
I used the Oak Ridge machine for that. And I have a nice big picture of that home on my
wall. Oh my gosh.
Unfortunately, it did, the properties were not very good, but we've identified that. You have the same problem here as you got with diffusion, is that you have to be absolutely clean, because any little particle of dust on the surface masks that beam, and so when you mask the beam and when the diffusion, it's the same as creating a hole through it. The emitter got shorter to the collector through that hole where you put an implant. And I'm looking at these and examining with the electron beam with the SEM, we could see some of these pipes in there. But anyway, the transistor was made. So
that was in what, 65, right?
And that was, yeah, that was in about mid 65.
Because it's around that time that you published also an article with James Gibbons. I was wondering what's the story behind the article then.
Well, I was never associated with that part of the university. Well, I was in school there, and I met Jim at a conference, and he was interested in he'd heard my paper. He was interested in the results that I was getting. And so we had a long discussion about them, and that was my last contact with Jim.
Because I found an article published under your name and his name.
That's interesting. I should have known that. Because he said he wanted to know if he could use some of the data that I had, and I said, sure.
Because I think I found it in the Applied Physics Letters, and there's a paper under his name, your name, and two other people there.
Now that's it. I'm going to have to go look that up, because he never indicated to me, he published, and I guess I just never came across it in the journal. But we never really worked together. We just talked together.
And actually, I was wondering about the conference. So you were talking about this conference for a nuclear physicist, right? And you had some interest from a French guy there. And so did you present your paper, your results at different other conferences?
Yes. We presented the results at an AIME conference in San Francisco, as I recall, the following year. And I think I upgraded some of the data, so it wasn't just a rehash of the same thing.
So that was the time when you saw Gibbons, right? So Gibbons
and
was about that paper.
I think that's when Gibbons and I talked,
And so I was wondering, what was the, I mean, Gibbons was the
well, he got very interested in implantation. In fact, as I recall, I think he put out a book and a number of papers, and I think some of his students have been working in that area.
And actually, I was wondering whether there were any semiconductor people at the IME meeting in San Francisco then, of solid state people there.
I think there were, but I didn't have any. As I recall, I got questions from the audience, which I'm sure came from semiconductor individuals. But even at that time, there was a real the kind of the external position was that damage is going to be the problem. And I don't think they fully accepted the data that we presented that indicated that we had removed the data. That, I think, was kind of the biggest hump that implantation had to get over.
And I was also wondering whether there was any competition between what you were doing at Sprague and the people at Ion Physics. I mean,
No, it was
just two independent things going on. And,
We kind of, all the data or all the work that was done at Ion Physics, I recall, was always done with a high energy beam. Primarily 100 keV up to a meg. Megavolt. And we had some concern, or I had some concern, of the energy input to the system. I mean, not only crystal damage, which we thought we could remove and show that we could remove with the low energy, but sufficient damage to even cast some preliminary melting of the system. So, and as I say, early in 64, after I got some of the first results, I mean, I proposed in my notebook that that might be a great way of doing channel doping for MOS. And with the high energies that they were using, that that just couldn't couldn't happen. Also, plus, in order to get the amount of dopant into the substrate for even resistors or what have you, would really either take a lot of time because you have to work at an extremely low beam current to compensate for the high energy for the high voltage, or you're going to have problems again, let's say, with disrupting the surface with the melting process. So we, what they were doing, in fact, I, I'm trying to remember, I think they were trying to do source and drains for MOS. And I think they were trying to, boy, we got to be careful. I think they were trying to attack the energy problem by using oxide thicknesses of such that that you could protect the surface. In other words, you're going to absorb a lot of that, plus a lot of the ions in the oxide. So one of the patents that they came out with was implanting through the oxide. In fact, yeah, that's interesting. They, MOSTEC, which we tied up with, was called up on that patent by Ion Physics, because what we were doing was all was implanting to the.
So there was a patent interference. There was a patent interference.
There was a patent on implanting through the oxide. That that King had. And so they we had a preliminary conference with the Ion Physics lawyer. Well, he actually took depositions. And before we had done this, I went back and really searched the literature because I hadn't done that that thoroughly. I was looking for information that ion physics may have put out either in reports. I mean, government contract. They were doing a lot of government contract here. And I found a government report that they wrote, which indicated they were implanting through oxides, which dated more than a year before they applied for the patent.
So it killed it, right?
So I said, geez, we got them. We got them by the... by the short hairs. And so when we got to that, that closed the conference very quickly. And I don't think they ever heard from ion physics after that. So that patent, which would have been a great patent had they not published before. Because primarily in the use for use of implantation in integrated circuits or any semiconductors, you normally use the oxide. And most of the implants are done through an oxide. For one reason or another. But now I lost my train of thought.
I was wondering, I mean, if we could go back a little bit in the past, and I was wondering why International Research Corporation was interested in that type of problem. So it was, I mean, it's clear for Sprague, right? But why would National Research Corporation be interested in
that? Well, because they were interested in the equipment side of it.
Oh, I see, okay.
Yeah, see, they primarily were equipment. They did much in the area of electron beams and and source design. In fact, they contributed quite a bit to to the system that we built. In building the source for us. When we got to that, before we got to that point, I hired John McDougall from McMaster's. And he had a lot of background in his graduate work in the area of source design and controlling beam parameters and what have you, and the work that he was doing. So I guess I met him at a conference in New York, talked to him a bit, and then after I got back, I got in touch with him and asked him if he might be interested in, in coming. And he had not yet quite finished his PhD program, but invited me out, and I went up into the lab and what he was doing.
So where was he?
In that's in Canada. In Montreal. So I went out and spent some time with him, and then we made him an offer. And after he finished up his work, he decided to come, and he still is with Allegro. See, Allegro spread off from Sprague before Sprague disappeared. And he's still with us.
So he joined your group in '66.
I hired him in '66.
I just want to make sure that we don't don't forget any other things. Something that I have here that I'm just curious about is that, I mean, if you look at the history of ion implantation, there were two groups that made a major impact, I mean, on instrumentation and the process, namely your group at Sprague, and ion physics was also important because it led to Esprion and the development of a big business making ion implanters, right? And what strikes me is that these two corporations were based in Massachusetts, right? So ion implantation was really developed to a large degree, I mean, for semiconductors in New England, and there was not much less work in other places, on the West Coast or or in Texas. I was wondering why there's is there any reason for that, or just
I don't think there's any real reason for that.
Okay.
Massachusetts is evidently a good place to to work, because I know one of the this is later on, one of the manufacturers of iron implantation put it, Extreon.
Yes.
Was based there in Massachusetts also.
Yeah.
But no, I'm not too up on the background of iron physics, but I kind of thought initially they were just high voltage equipment people, just the same as NRC was kind of low voltage equipment people.
Okay. Because what is interesting is that many of the people who started Extreon were at iron physics before.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a move of techniques and knowledge, know-how between one to the other. Right. So.
Yeah. I never really gave that a thought, but I can't think of a basic reason except Massachusetts is a good place to work.
Absolutely.
You know?
Okay.
Why that might be.
And also, I mean, I wanted to ask you about the article that you published in Solid State Technology in 1966. So you published an article on the art of semiconductor doping by iron implantation in Solid State Technology in 66. And I was wondering about the background of this article. And
That came along just kind of naturally, I think, because it's always kind of been my position that research is good if you can apply it. I mean, research for research and it's might be self-satisfying to someone, but it doesn't help what we're doing. So as with that philosophy, the natural thing that I do is say, well, how are we going to use this iron implantation that we've shown?
Okay.
Because it's as you do it to find out what you can do, as I say, as we did the implantation for finding out if we could put the ions into the silicon and remove the damage and make usable junk oil, that no way relates to how do you adapt that to a process where a different process where one is a low temperature process and one is a high temperature process, and you got to make them match. So what we did is look at areas that we could use this technique in, and then determine how we interface this technique with the remainder of the process to make whatever the device or IC is. And so one of the natural things that you think about is relates back to that Concord problem that I told you about, is how do you now improve, use it to improve the precision and accuracy of diffusions as we presently need them in our microcircuits, which are much deeper than what you can do with implantations what have you, in order to reach the parameters that you need for the devices. Well, the normal thing is, you use it just like you do a pre-dep for a diffusion. So you pre-dep with this, and with this case, you can control very accurately what concentration of material you put in that pre-dep. And then when you do the diffusion, you're going to get the same the same parameters for that junction all the way through. So the thing is, can you get sufficient material in for the source for your diffusion? And which we needed to cover and showed mm-hmm. we had. In fact, mm-hmm. one of the outcomes of this, one of mm-hmm. the early outcomes of this mm-hmm. program, was the PNPs I talked about at Concord.
Yes.
They have implanted bases.
So that was in 66, right? 60.
Yeah, that was in 67, about 67, 68.
Okay. Wow,
basically.
Okay.
We introduced, we can, the other thing, of course, you got to convince your manufacturing people that what you're doing is going to be okay.
Of course, yeah.
And so we've always tried to to maintain a real good working relationship with our manufacturing groups.
Okay.
And that's kind of the key in the semiconductor industry to making things good.
Okay.
And we did that and provided them with data uh-huh. they could understand uh-huh. and showed them the results of what we did. I mean, we made a lot of PNPs in our lab.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
just to look at the parameters and properties.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Showed them that, and they agreed. And so now, or not now, they're not there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But when they were in the business era, and there was still a Sprague Electric up there, their PNPs were ion implanted bases, and they got beautiful yields.
Mm-hmm.
And the parameters were just always really
So did you make also ion implanted bipolar integrated circuits at that time?